All right, that's it. Shut it all down for 2 days. Let's try again on Monday, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 29th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to wrap up the day and the week and the month in the next 7 minutes of live radio, or we're going to try real hard to. Anyway, Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Sadiq Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai. Hey,
so, Lynette, let me start with you, and I want to start with some consumer-oriented numbers out this morning. Personal spending and personal income both up, which I find interesting because consumers in this economy are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? The supply chain glueiness that is just terrible still, and the demand that they have, and they can't get what they want. How do we account for consumers, you know, being so optimistic still?
Americans have money right now. People saved up during the pandemic. We're ready to spend. We don't have necessarily access to all the things that we want to get. And there's a little bit of a pylon in the ocean right now. It's just a bit of a traffic jam. But I think that kind of stuff will sort itself out. And I think people are getting a little, you know, they're worried about the holidays coming up. I think people are starting to plan early because they know how slow things are to get to them. So we're going to keep seeing movement in this economy. Consumer spending didn't go up as much as it did last time. Mm-hmm. We're slowing that growth a little bit. But September was a tough month. You know, Delta reared its ugly head and schools are like, you know, splotchy and opening and closing. And, you know, we're still in a weird funk.
Sadiq, so. I want to, funk. F-U-N-K. Sudeep, talk to me about gross domestic product, three other letters in this economy, GDP. Not up as much as everybody wanted to be July through September.
Yeah, those were the Delta months. Those are the months where everything, where our excitement about the reopening turned into another round of depression about being indoors and not being able to go out and spend. And it does feel like people are once again just eager to get back out there. You can hope that the boosters and all these other steps we're taking with kids, with the new approvals for the youngest children, all of that will make a difference. And maybe we won't have to go through too many more rounds of this. But obviously, we came through a rough period, but then we're about to go into the winter months where we know what happened last year with COVID. And so we have one more rough stretch before we can get out of this. But that was really the driver of a big part of the GDP shortfall.
Just what we need, one more rough stretch. All right, Lynette, at the risk of making you sad, I'm going to turn us to inflation now and full disclosure. I know. But we were chatting, just for people listening, we were chatting before we turned the microphones on. And Lynette was like, oh, geez, do we have to talk about inflation? And sadly, we do. And here's why.
It's all anyone's talking about.
I know. And we're going to spend 2 minutes, but then we'll move on. But I do want to talk about what Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on CNBC this morning, speaking from Rome, which will explain the sirens in the background. She was asked whether she still thinks it's going to be transitory. Here's Janet Yellen.
Well, I think it's still fair to use it in the sense that even if it doesn't mean a month or two, it means a little bit longer than that. I think it conveys that the pressures that we're seeing are related to a unique shock to the economy.
All right. So, Lynette, here's what I want to know from you. Do you think people really grasp that when Yellen and Jay Powell say inflation is going to be transitory, what that means is that the rate of inflation is going to become more normal, not that prices are necessarily going to go back down?
That I think people understand what that means, but it's really the transitory, the meaning of the word transitory that I think also gets people going. You know, Wall Street has the attention span and patience of a teenage fruit fly. Yeah. So when they hear transitory, they're like, okay, this is just about over. Janet Yellen and Powell never said that. We don't necessarily know if transitory is 3 months or 6 months. But it just means that the rate will go down over time. People are already panicking because they don't see that happening yet. But I don't understand how you would expect the transitory period to be over when we still have not figured out the bottlenecks in this economy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sudeep, thoughts on inflation, or would you prefer to go straight to my Jay Powell question? Up to you.
You know, this could come straight to your Jay Powell question anyway, and that this is the challenge that the Fed and the Treasury Secretary have in communicating this, because they're using inflation and rates of change, and a lot of people just want this to be want things to go back to normal. There's a way for the Fed to fix this, and they can fix it really quickly by slowing down the economy, but nobody really wants that outcome either. And so what they're trying to do is reassure people that there are, it is true, these are unique issues. We have never had a case like this with tankers just like packed with material just sitting off coast. And so that part is transitory, but there are other parts of it that are probably going to stick around for longer than any of us expected a few months ago.
Lynette, on that note of the Fed slowing down the economy, they meet next week. They are almost certainly not going to do anything about interest rates. But I do wonder whether you think they're going to announce that the taper will begin. That is to say, they're going to slow down their bond buying program. You, what do you think?
I don't know.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, they might announce a slowing. You know, it looks like the rest of the world is considering tightening, but do you, I don't know.
I do, yeah.
Maybe. You think so? Yeah. Okay. I don't know.
Well, here we go. Thanks for coming and interviewing on my show. Sudeep, what do you got?
It's a slow march toward the result that had to happen at some point. And so the timing is unfortunate for the Fed to have a weak GDP report, some crummy jobs numbers, all of this, but they can't keep with record after record on just about everything. They can't keep pouring money into the system this way that they're doing. They have to slow it down. They have to pull it back so that they don't create even more problems. And we can't be talking about transitory inflation 3 years from now, and they know that. And so they've got to come back a little bit, and we'll probably get another signal from the Fed that they're going to actually start the taper in December, as they've been telling us, or at least indicating for months.
Yeah. Sudeep, last question to you, and we got like 35, 40 seconds for you to answer it in. It occurred to me this week, as those tax proposals were flying fast and furious on Capitol Hill in order to pay for the Build Back Better plan. You know, they were talking about the billionaire tax and the corporate minimum tax and all of this. This is really an infrastructure bill, a human infrastructure bill that is sort of masquerading, or it's a tax overhaul masquerading as a social infrastructure bill.
Yeah, and they're trying, this is all for show. Like all these pay-fors, everything they're trying to come up with is for show, to say that this is deficit neutral.
Yeah.
The people they're taxing will almost certainly find a way around the taxation, or at least much of it. And so that's why everyone knows this is a bit of an exercise just for optics right now. But they will pass
something. I just hope someone's writing it all down.
Somebody is writing all down, but you know what?
There's so many different plans. I hope somebody is taking notes.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, guys.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, record high after record high after record high after record high. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, more inflation, with apologies to Lynette Lopez. There is a part of the inflation story that is maybe not getting the attention it should. Overall, from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, personal income and outlays report this morning, inflation is running at 4.4%. For the core, that's excluding food and energy, even though we all have to eat and use energy, 3.6%. It's high, but it's steady. But here's the thing I wanted to tell you. We also got data on wage inflation today in the form of the Labor Department's Employment Cost Index, literally what it costs employers to employ people, wages, benefits, the whole smash. That was up 3.7% in the third quarter from a year ago. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains the wage-price connection.
Up till now, the main reason for sharp price rises has been the messed up pandemic supply chain. But the rising cost of wages and benefits is potentially more troubling, up about 4% in the private sector year over year, around 7% for hotel and restaurant workers, more than 8% in financial services.
It was pretty fast wage growth. It was, one data point, but we'll keep an eye on it.
Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute says if employers keep raising wages this much, they could be driven to raise prices too.
That sort of wage price spiral is what worries kind of macro policymakers like the Federal Reserve the most. That's the thing, the genie they don't want to let out of the bottle.
Like what happened in the bad old 1970s, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson.
Workers trying to build into their contracts automatic wage increases of 5 or 6% because they think I'm going to need that just to be able to buy the same set of things I was buying the year before. And that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
But workers today don't have nearly as much leverage as they did in the 70s, says Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial Network.
We don't have the union participation. We don't have the industry-wide labor agreements. I think it's going to be a much tougher path to see that kind of wage price spiral take off.
McMillan sees the current increase in worker compensation in a more virtuous cycle kind of light.
That money, if it goes into consumers' pockets, actually is going to help the economy grow going forward.
And the biggest pay hikes right now are going to younger workers and service workers in low-wage professions who need the money most to keep up with rising prices. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, that was Mitchell on wage inflation. Here is another kind, commodity inflation, propane specifically. Something like 5% of American households burn propane to keep warm, and they are in for a more expensive winter. Residential propane is averaging $2.60-something cents a gallon, the highest it's been in a decade. And of course, the colder the weather, the higher the demand. Prices thus react accordingly. And as Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports, rural parts of this country are bracing themselves.
Residents of Shiprock, New Mexico, only have a few options when it comes to home heating.
Wood stove, coal stoves, pellet stoves.
The other option, says Eugenia Charles Newton, is propane.
And in some communities that don't have clean water, it's used to boil water.
She represents Shiprock in the Navajo Nation Council and says many in her community are on tight budgets.
You find yourself having to decide, is propane more important than food or is propane more important than gas to drive to work?
Most U.S. households are heated with natural gas or electricity. Unlike propane, those markets are highly regulated, which somewhat insulates consumers from big price swings. But those energy sources don't reach every corner of America.
So if you're up in rural Ohio or Minnesota, you don't have access to natural gas because of the pipeline system doesn't get to that last mile.
S&P Global Platts analyst Robert Steer says at this point in a typical year, U.S. propane producers would have plenty stored to sell domestically. But this year, international demand has been exceptionally strong.
So we're going into winter right now with seasonally low inventories.
Just how much that continues to drive up prices depends on how cold of a winter we have. John Nelson lives in Rugby, North Dakota, about 50 miles from the Canadian border, and serves in the State House of Representatives. When propane prices spike, his community feels it.
It impacts everybody, but certainly the individuals that are on a fixed income.
Nelson is warning his constituents to budget for higher heating bills. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
I mentioned consumer spending up at the top of the program, up in September, even though the last gasp of federal virus relief money ended early in the month. So we decided to give one of our retail regulars a call. Kristen Tullheimer Bingham is the co-owner of Dean's Sweets. They're in Portland, Maine.
The last couple of months have been busy, very, very busy. We're still getting most of our business from our original store. The walk-in traffic there has really grown tremendously over the past several months. We've definitely gotten a lot more corporate orders and turndown service. It's kind of all over the map, to tell you the truth. But we've also just started working with a brand new hotel, and so they seem to be ramping up their turndown service and their guest amenities. Our prices have stayed the same for a long, long time, and we are feeling a little bit of a crunch. Our payroll is higher because we have so much more demand. And right now, we're still going to stay the course in terms of our prices. We're not planning on raising them in the foreseeable future. You know, if we sell more chocolate with a lower profit margin, we're still going to be okay. But we can see a path to remaining profitable if we continue to see greater demand.
Kristen Tallheimer-Bingham there, making chocolate at Dean Sweets in Portland, Maine. Coming up.
And it becomes more obvious who the losers are.
Capitalism can be tough, you know? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 89 points today, 0.2%, 35,819. The NASDAQ added 50 points, about 0.3%, 15,498. S&P 500 found 8 points, a 10%, 46.5. For the week, the Dow gained 0.4%, the NASDAQ banked 2.7%, the S&P 500 added 1.3%. Big month for all three. The Dow registered its biggest monthly gain since March. The NASDAQ and the S&P saw their biggest monthly percentage gain since November last. Can't be Halloween weekend without talking about candy. Let's see how well the big confectioners did today. Tootsie Roll Industries fell 0.2%. Hershey gave back 2.2%. Your reality check number of this day is $102. That's how much the National Retail Federation figures an American is going to spend on Halloween this year. That is an all-time high. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today, in late-stage capitalism, it's now going to cost you an extra $9.95 to get that order of organic milk and fancy olives straight to your door. Amazon is done with those free Whole Foods deliveries. It's a sign that, yes, even the biggest of big retail giants has decided it makes sense somehow to pass those delivery costs and some other expenses onto their loyal, for now, customers. Marketplace's Amanda Petra has that one.
Deliveries are a headache for grocers. Refrigerated trucks, tight windows for perishable food, and driver wages, those costs add up for retailers.
Maybe $7 a delivery.
Sucharita Kodali is a retail analyst at Forrester. She says it's just not a service that makes much sense.
Grocery, in the best of circumstances, is a very low margin business. And then when you add delivery on top of it, it's just unprofitable.
People don't like to pay for things that are not actual products, like parking, packaging, or delivery. Ayelet Fishbeck, professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, says that's why online retailers will often reveal fees when you're ready to check out.
At that point, you're probably too tired to pay attention to these costs. You're already too invested in getting these groceries, and so you are likely to pay.
And in this economy, says Diane Smith at Mintel, fees feel inevitable.
Given the where inflation rates are right now and the increasing prices that retailers are having to absorb, they are unfortunately having to pass along some costs to consumers. And it is risky.
Risky because some customers will reject those costs, like Henry Carell, who used to get Whole Foods deliveries 2 or 3 times a month in Chicago, sometimes more last winter when it was freezing for weeks.
The ability to not leave the house was spectacular.
But he's not happy with the fee.
It feels ticky-tacky on top of already paying that Amazon Prime annual membership.
Carell shops at Target now, but he says he might be less grumpy about the Whole Foods fee when snow falls again. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
We're all going to be talking more about climate change for the next couple of weeks. COP26, that's the big UN climate conference, starts this weekend in Glasgow. And somewhere Up high on the agenda, number one on the agenda, you might imagine, will be ideas to cut carbon emissions. And among them is a carbon tax, a price on pollution fundamentally, which a whole lot of economists agree is the most efficient way to reduce the amount of carbon we are spewing out into the atmosphere. More than 20 jurisdictions around the world already have some kind of carbon tax. The United States, however, is not one of those jurisdictions. We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to find out why not.
The idea of a carbon tax first got tossed around during the energy crisis in the 1970s. You put a fee on something like gasoline and people will use less of it. It's a solution that a lot of economists love because it's really easy to implement.
If you want to say from an economic standpoint, how do you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the lowest economic cost? I can't think of anyone that wouldn't say a carbon tax is right at the top of that list.
That's Shiling Su. He teaches environmental law at Florida State University, and he wrote a book called The Case for a Carbon Tax. Su says the carbon tax in the Canadian province of British Columbia has reduced greenhouse gas emissions without compromising economic growth. Britain also introduced a tax on carbon emissions in 2013. Researchers from University College London found it drove down the amount of electricity generated from coal from 40% to just 3%. So if it works, why don't we have one in the U.S.?
I think the short answer is lobbying.
That's Tom Lyon. He's a professor of sustainability at the University of Michigan. The fossil fuel industry outspends the renewable energy sector on political contributions by 13 to 1, according to scholars at Yale. A lot of companies outside the energy sector say they want to cut carbon emissions, but Lyon says they aren't putting their political money where their mouths are.
They'll say good things, but they don't allocate large amounts of lobbying dollars and effort to the cause.
A carbon tax is also up against the fact that nobody really likes the idea of more taxes, no matter what the goal is. Orrin Cass, the conservative think tank American Compass, says the important question is who ends up paying.
It's a deeply, deeply regressive tax that disproportionately lands on lower income households who spend disproportionately more of their income on energy.
That's true. But Larry Goulder at Stanford says there's a way to fix that.
A lot of the proposals for a carbon tax are for a revenue-neutral carbon tax, which means that whatever gross revenues are brought in are returned to the private sector in the form of a fixed check back to every American household in equal amounts.
A check for, say, $200 isn't going to do anything for a corporate CEO, but it would mean a lot to low-income families struggling to pay their utility bills. But any policy change is going to be a tough sell in Washington because so many lawmakers' constituents would be affected. That's according to Robertson Williams. He's an economist at the University of Maryland.
The fundamental political problem here is that deep cuts in emissions require substantial changes to our energy system. And that's going to create winners and losers, and the losers are going to fight it.
Now, there are other ways to reduce carbon emissions, Williams says. California, for example, has set higher fuel efficiency standards for cars, and it sends checks to drivers who buy electric vehicles.
The big advantage of those is that they make the cost less obvious. With a carbon tax, it's very obvious what the cost is, and it becomes more obvious who the losers are. With some of these other policies, you can hide what the cost is and hide who the losers are.
What those policies don't do, and a carbon tax would, is provide information on how much consumers and companies are willing to pay to pollute. That data could help lawmakers and regulators craft policies that don't fall hardest on those who can least afford it. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I will only say this, don't do this. You know Squid Game, the Netflix show that was the hottest thing in the world like 10 days ago? Yeah, well, it seems that there is now a cryptocurrency based on or inspired by the show. It is technically what's called a play-to-earn token used in a game about the show that is set to start next month. Anyway, Squid, S-Q-U-I-D, it's all caps, by the way, is up 86,249% Tuesday to Friday from a penny, less than a penny actually, to $11.16. Again, no matter how big a fan you are of this show, don't do this. All right, we're out of here. But first, your moment of economic context. Shares of Meta Platforms Incorporated, the company formerly known as Facebook, up 2.5% today. And I mention it because I forgot to point out earlier this week, just as all those Facebook stories were hitting and the company was having its earnings call, you know how many questions from Wall Street analysts there were about the Facebook papers and all what's going on inside that company? Zero. None. Not a one. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.